I think, by the way, I've got someone on the line who knows more about this than I do. Peter Robinson, are you there?
I am, Phil. How are you?
Not bad. I was struggling along through the story. I'm sorry it took us a little time to reach you, but fortunately, we have a lot of wonderful people here. Got it done. Peter, I'm telling the story of, as best I can, which as it unfolds, it is so infuriating, and I know you're the lawyer, you have a client, but it's the whole matter of how your client and six others find themselves in Niger, and in his case, an innocent person, acquitted, and everyone is sort of standing by twiddling their thumbs. Could you explain the process? Why did they have to leave the Tanzania and be transferred to Niger? How did that unfold?
Well, my client was acquitted in 2014. Some of the others were acquitted even earlier, but they had no place to go. No country would accept them. Their families were in Europe. They became French citizens. All my client's four children and his wife, but France refused to accept him, even though he was acquitted of war crimes and crimes against humanity. So he was forced to remain in Arusha, Tanzania, where the jail was when he was released. And the Tanzanian government allowed them to stay there, but didn't give them any kind of papers or any kind of resident status. And that situation continued while the registry of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda went out of business, and their new successor institution, which is called the Residual Mechanism for International Criminal Tribunals, came into existence and took over this problem of these guys in Arusha with no place to go, and really Tanzania was not happy to have them stay there. So the registrar of that new mechanism went around and tried to find a place for them and reached an agreement with the government of Niger, in which the government of Niger agreed to relocate the eight people who were left and to give them residence permits so that they could work in Niger. And the UN agreed to give them $10,000 and a house to get started. And so back in December of 2021, my client and the others accepted that agreement and hoped to start a new life in Niger and be able to work and do something productive. And that's how it got started.
Yeah. And by the way, I have to say, ask you, my understanding is that when they, it was sort of somebody might call a bum's rush. They came to them with timetables and deadlines, and you have to make up your mind, but there was no consultation with any attorneys. You weren't consulted, were you, about this process?
Yes, I was consulted, actually. I mean, it was on a relatively short deadline, but I and other lawyers were consulted about this. And frankly, I thought it was a good idea because I thought getting out of Arusha in the kind of limbo that they've lived in for so long, they were totally bored and depressed in that house in Arusha without really being able to do anything. So
limbo to limbo.
To worse. Limbo to detention. But yeah. Yeah.
So now they arrive there, and of course, we listeners know what we know. There's now a political crisis in Niger. So the president who made the agreements, I noticed, incidentally, this is Peter Robinson. He has a Twitter account. I think it's still called Twitter. Maybe not. But anyway, Peter Robinson, M-I-C-S, is it?
MICT, which is short for this mechanism that they set up.
For the mechanism. Yeah. What a wonderful name.
Yeah.
So now that president is gone and raising really new problems. But tell us where they are and what is their conditions like before the crisis. And we'll come to, I guess, the crisis.
Yeah, well, they are in a house in Niamey, the capital of Niger, and they went there and they were given this house to stay in, and they were given residence papers, and it looked like everything was going to be okay. except the Rwandan government hadn't been consulted. And when they found out about it, they pressured the government of Niger to expel them back to Rwanda. And they don't care that these guys have been acquitted. They're ready to put them on trial again and imprison them. Mm-hmm. So the UN intervened and at least stopped the expulsion, but the government of Niger refuses to let them leave their house, and so they've been under house arrest for more than 19 months, since late December of 2021. And that's the situation they find themselves in right now. They're in a house. There are policemen guarding the house, so they can't leave. And they're basically sweltering in the heat of Niger.
Not the climate they grew up in.
Yeah, not the climate they grew up in, and with no support, visitors, no ability to go out and out of their house, and it's terrible.
Has there been contact with them since this taking of power by the generals?
Yes, I'm in contact with my client several times a day, actually, because we're trying to monitor the situation. He's able to contact me by WhatsApp or by email.
Good.
And the situation since the coup started has gotten worse, because now with sanctions that have been imposed, there are power cuts and blackouts, basically, so they don't have a steady stream of power.
And the threat of a war.
Yeah, the threat of a war is imminent, and also there are shortages now of goods because of the closing of the borders and panic buying by Niger citizens. So it's a very tense situation there right now.
And you have argued, and I believe other counsel have, that this is a, and I know I have, I've been involved in some of this, this is a United Nations responsibility. The United Nations has a prison in The Hague. Why aren't they afforded the courtesy, the right to be held at least by the UN where the UN has authority?
Exactly. We have asked this several times with all kinds of arguments, every argument we could possibly think of to get them brought back to The Hague, where they, and even though they're entitled to be free because they've been acquitted, they're willing to sit in prison in The Hague rather than sit there in Niger in the middle of a coup with the threat of expulsion to Rwanda. Mm-hmm. But the mechanism won't even do that, and we've been very disappointed with the judicial decisions of the mechanism, which basically wash their hands of the problem and say it's a diplomatic problem to be solved by the United Nations. Meanwhile, the United Nations has found absolutely no country willing to take these guys, and so they're in this limbo where everybody says it's somebody else's responsibility.
You know, remember, Peter, this tribunal set itself up as to be an example of how to administer justice. The opening speeches at the ICTR were all full of wonderful rhetoric about due process and ending the culture of impunity. But you know, the UN seems to have impunity. I think if your client was on Guantanamo, you would have more power to do something about it because you could sue the American government. What can you do with the UN, which has robbed your client of his freedom?
Yeah, that's true. The UN cannot be sued in any jurisdiction. You can't take them to the International Court of Justice. There's nothing you could do other than try to persuade the judges to make a judicial order and have some courage, which they've been unwilling to do so far, or to try to persuade some country to step up and make a statement for international justice and take these people. But so far, we've tried endlessly to accomplish those things with no result.
I was thinking, too, about, you know, you as a defense lawyer, it seems to me you've been very exemplary. And it's at Peter Robinson, MICT. If you want to, people should be following this. There's also the families, Save Our Parents group has been trying to do something. But I don't see why it just falls to defense counsel or the scattered voices of civil liberties, human rights, and all that. Where are the former judges who sent these individuals either to a short to a sentence if they've served or acquitted them? Judge Pile or Judge Mose, or we have a new attorney. I don't know if you know this. A new attorney general in Canada, Arif Vivani, I think his name is. I'm sorry to mispronounce me. He, by the way, was in a case versus you, in the Caramera case, and he partly was elected on the fact that he had done such a marvelous job in Arusha. Why aren't these? They're part of the same judicial process. If someone's acquitted, why aren't they as passionate as you about getting these individuals out of a problem?
Yeah, we tried. We actually sent an email to all of the former officials of the tribunal in Rwanda, the judges, some prosecutors, and asked them if they could intervene with their own governments to try to help us or do anything else they could to try to eliminate this stain on international justice. And to his credit, Judge Mosa did respond. He's from Norway, and he encouraged the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Norway to do something, but they decided not to.
But we had
really no other responses.
That was the only response. Mose does dot his I's and cross his T's.
Yes, he does.
Yeah. Arif Vivani is the guy's, is the individual's name. We'll try to approach him about this. But, you know, there's also a gulag. There are individuals in Benin and in Mali, which is not the happiest state of affairs at the moment. And they're in the same situation, right?
Well, they're in a different situation in the sense that they are serving their sentences. Well, many of them are serving
But they can't
their
go
sentences.
Home. They can't go to Europe.
No, they can't. When they are released...
They can be happy. They can be released, but they're not... They can't go home to where their families are.
There is a handful of them that are released after serving their sentence who are in Mali or in Benin or and maybe one other country that... And they can't leave, so they're not under house arrest, so they're free to walk around the town, but they can't get jobs because they don't get any papers, and they can't rejoin their families in Europe because the European countries refuse to take them, even some who have been acquitted or those that have completed their sentences.
We just had recently had the death of the gentleman, Mr. Mavunyi. And there was a question. His lawyers, as my understanding, had notified the mechanism that he was in desperate need of help. He has died. What is the medical? What quality of medical care is available there? Do you know?
Well, it's not particularly good. He was in the hospital for a little while, and then he came back to the house. They thought that they had done what they were supposed to for him, and then he died a few days later in the shower in that house with my client and the others. Very traumatic for our clients and for his family. So this is definitely not conducive to good medical care, and all of these guys are in their 60s, 70s, and even 80s.
Yeah, you know, that again, to me, raises the issue of The Hague, where... I, as far as I know, the Hague conditions are somewhat superior, and where the access to appropriate medical care is easier than for those who are scattered around Africa.
Yeah, that is true.
You know, I recall Judge Khama, when I really hated him for saying this, he said, they're going to be here... for social and cultural reasons, which all that told me was they had a tier system. Europeans would be treated one way, and for social cultural reasons, black Africans were treated another way. I don't know if you agree with that, but anyhow.
Well, I don't know. I have to say that having worked at both the Yugoslavian tribunals and the Rwandan tribunals, there was a huge difference in the quality of the personnel that was assigned to the Rwandan tribunal. They were nowhere near as skilled as those in the Yugoslavian tribunal, and the amount of resources that were made available to the Rwandan tribunal wasn't as good as the tribunal in the former Yugoslavia.
I want to mention, I was looking up your client who was acquitted, and I just took the popular view of him. Seems to me that part of this is the demonization of these individuals, despite the fact, in his case, acquitted. I read about him in it's Wikipedia, and they describe all the crimes and allegations and all sorts of things evil about him. Then the last sentence said, he was acquitted.
I mean, the narrative that follows each of these people to the tribunal when they first get there makes it almost impossible to get a fair trial because they're really presumed guilty. And even in those instances where people, despite all those odds, have managed to get acquitted, that narrative never changes. And that's why my client right now can't go to any European country because they say that under the Refugee Convention, he's excludable as a war criminal despite his acquittal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I hate to say it. I mean, this is the problem of media not doing their job. Why didn't they report on that trial? Because given the atmosphere, he had to be very clean, I would say, to beat the charge. Because of all the presumptions about him.
Absolutely.
Could you talk a little bit about him, by the way? Could you describe him, say what was found at the trial?
Yeah. His name is François Xavier Zwaname, and he was a major in the Army of Rwanda and a career military officer, not particularly high ranking, but at the time his unit was assigned to, when the genocide broke out, they were assigned to protect different officials in Rwanda, including the prime minister, and he was accused of being liable for the death of the prime minister, which took place on the first day of the genocide. Mm-hmm. And so that's basically a little bit about what he was accused of. But as an individual, he's extremely soft-spoken, modest, kind individual. And I have found him to be, you know, a very, very good client in terms of his knowledge, his appreciation of what lawyers are doing for him, and his reasonableness about what can be expected. And it's a real privilege to represent someone like him.
Yeah. And how was that case won? What was the quality of the evidence? What did the judges find in that case?
Well, in the end, the judges found that there was no link between any of his conduct and the murder of the prime minister.
They tried to put the prime minister and the Belgians on his list.
Yes, they did.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And so but they didn't really have any evidence of that other than his formal position, which when the genocide broke out, formal positions didn't mean that much because there were aggressive people who took command and reasonable people who were sidelined. And so it was sort of a simplistic approach taken by the Rwandan tribunal prosecutors to try to put people who held positions of authority on trial, even if the reality was they didn't have authority at that time.
And isn't the phrase, knew or should have known, that, and often they convict people on that?
Yeah,
because you're the major, one of your soldiers did something, you should have known, we got you.
Yeah, they do.
But they didn't do that with Zwaname.
Well, he wasn't charged with command responsibility. They tried to say that he was directly responsible, as part of a sort of a joint criminal enterprise with others who were committing those crimes.
Yeah. So there was a zealotry, I think, wouldn't you agree, in the way they went at this. You recall that General Kabilegi was acquitted, and everyone was stunned, but the problem was that they had assumed he was in the country when it wasn't there.
Yeah. I mean, something that's actually very sad about the Rwandan tribunal is that they remain there, people who were convicted, who had absolutely nothing to do with the events that they were convicted of. And I find this to be one of the saddest things of my experience in Rwandan tribunal, because at the trials, the Tutsi survivors believed that there was nothing wrong to say that they saw a minister at a roadblock with a machete giving out weapons or ordering killings, because in their minds, they believed that because they were a minister, they must be responsible for the genocide, and therefore, they didn't say anything morally wrong with claiming to have seen them, even if he wasn't there. And people were convicted for that. And that kind of testimony was also buttressed by some Hutus who were in prison and found a way to testify and incriminate people because they would get a reduced sentence in prison. So the confluence of that made the Rwandan tribunal a perfect storm for perjury.
Yeah.
And some people were acquitted, but there are still people serving their sentences who were wrongfully convicted, and I feel very sad about that.
There, usually, when you have people who say, "Well, I was involved, and he gave me the orders," that's, you're supposed to take that with a grain of salt if you're a judge, because the decision to give evidence against somebody else in order to get off, that's a rather well-known phenomenon in North American legal culture.
And our judges are used to requiring corroboration. That's basically the touchstone for whether someone is telling the truth, is to see how they're corroborated. Is there documentary evidence, contemporaneous records, things like that, that show that it really happened the way they said it? Mm-hmm. And in Rwanda, they didn't have corroboration in the form of documentary evidence or intercepts or things like that. So they corroborated witnesses with other witnesses who were telling the same story but had the same motivation.
Peter, I really appreciate all the time you're giving us. I think this is a very important subject. Also, it's a sort of health and safety issue. There ought to be an emergency step taken. Somebody from the UN should contact the new government, such as it is, and say, we're not involved in your disputes internally. We do have some people there that we are responsible for. We ask you, please, just hand them to us so that they will be separated from the subject, your problems within Niger, wouldn't you think?
Oh, definitely. We're asking them to do that. In fact, the new government can actually show that they're even better than the old government.
This is their chance.
Just let these guys take away the policemen from their residence and honor the agreement that was made in the first place. The current president of Niger wrote an op-ed in which he said that he was a hostage, but he's been holding our clients hostage for the last 19 months. So I'm hoping maybe
they could put him in the house with your guys.
Yeah, well, there's an extra bedroom, unfortunately, because of one of our...
You can't use the shower right away because there's three other guys ahead of you with that.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Anyway, in all seriousness, it's a really fluid situation there, so it's not really hard to know.
No, they have a duty. I mean, this is a crumbling disgrace of a court if they cannot... have a process in which people receive justice, and when they're acquitted, they're patted on the back and say goodbye, and you're free. Instead, we have this really ugly thing going on where people say, "Well, we don't like them anyway, so they have to rot."
It's a real disappointment.
And lastly, Peter, I want to ask. I was there, of course, when the Karamera case began, and you gave a very eloquent opening address to the court, and you said that you were going to show who shot down the plane, which caused, we all agree, prosecution and the defense, is the trigger for the violence that followed. And don't you wish you'd been able to proceed with that? And also, don't you think that is still a seminal question that everyone ought to address, is who shot the plane down?
Yes, I do. And I think the UN knew who shot the plane down, and that's why they didn't want any evidence of it to come into the trial.
Yes. Was it Del Ponte who said if it was the RPF, we would have to reorient our entire theory of this case? if I'm paraphrasing.
Not only that, but they would never get any cooperation from Rwanda. No witnesses would ever come to testify, and they would be blocked as a court. And they made the very practical decision to just keep in good graces with the government of Rwanda and therefore be able to continue to do their work and collect their salaries. And
how it all went. As an experienced prosecutor and lawyer, wouldn't the appropriate thing to say, if a state says, well, I'm not going to cooperate with you if you look at my people, the answer would be, well, then the court will have to close.
Yeah, wouldn't, and they could have
invited those You throw people. The case out. You don't get to accuse somebody while you withhold information that is might be exculpatory, basically.
Yeah, I mean, there was a watershed moment for the court back in the early 2000s when the court of the appeals chamber dismissed the charges against someone who was a high-level person accused of inciting the genocide on the radio, John Bosco Barrigueza. And when they did that, the Rwandan government was so incensed, they said, we're not sending any more witnesses to testify. Mm-hmm. And the court backed off and reconsidered on its own motion the decision and decided they found some reason to say, no, we made a mistake, and in fact, we're not going to dismiss his case. Ever since that moment, the government of Rwanda had the kind of leverage over that court and over the UN that skewed the fairness of the trial.
Yeah. Yes, and Barrigueza died in custody. Very nice man, I remember. Peter Robinson, it's been great talking to you. It's at, and our listeners should go to Peter at Peter Robin, MICT, so that you can follow what is happening because this is urgent, and I hope people will do what they can. Maybe get in touch with the Attorney General of Canada. Peter, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for your interest in this, Phil, and I really appreciate it. So does my client.
All right, thank you. We'll talk soon. Bye bye.
Bye.